Hello and welcome to Healing From Within. I am your host, Cheryl Glick, author of The Living Spirit, Answers for Healing and Infinite Love, which shares stories, miracles, and insights into the metaphysical world of energy possibilities and ways you may rise to a higher level of consciousness or awareness of our human and divine essence. Today I welcome Dr. Miguel Farias, author of The Buddha Pill, which questions both the efficacy and also highlights the darker side of the mindfulness movement. You know, Miguel, like everything else in life, there are always two sides to every issue, and yeah, we can examine them for greater clarity. Hello, Miguel, and thank you for joining me on the show.
Hello, Cheryl. So nice to talk to you.
Miguel, you know, as listeners of Healing From Within over the years have come to know, my guest and I explore the multidimensional aspects of life in both its physical and energetic components in the search for greater awareness of the human and divine matrix of possibilities for creation, change, and evolution. In today's episode of Healing From Within, we will discuss and explore the human ambition for personal change and its possible illusions, with a focus on yoga and meditation. The Buddha Pill is a balanced view of meditative techniques, suggesting that personal chance affected by these spiritual practices vary widely from one individual to another, and that peace and compassion touted by instructors may not always be the end result or may not be lasting. Miguel, I always ask my guests to think back to their earlier days, perhaps their childhood, and remember a person, event, experience, or feeling that showed you some of the interests or values or work that might come later in your life, as you may have been influenced earlier on in life to find your path. So think back for a minute where your interest lied then.
Yes, that's an easy one. So I grew up in the late 70s in Portugal, when there was an extraordinary period after 40 years of a dictatorship. There had been a peaceful transition to democracy, and there was this atmosphere of ecstasy in the air that everything, anything was possible. So I remember growing up with lots of, well, there were parties in which these ideas of liberty were discussed and sung, the liberty in which one could grow to express one's true self.
The word I'm hearing, Miguel, intuitively, is hope. You had great hope to find the ways for people to live their best life, the best version of themselves.
Yes, that was it. You're right.
Past the drama and trauma and disappointment of seeing, as a sensitive person, I sense you are that. And we feel greatly when others are emotionally distressed or in pain, and we feel their suffering. And so we, those of us that have this deep sense, we do have great hope and trust that the best in ourselves and others can come out. Very beautifully said. Tell us something about your interests later on in yoga, meditation, and how these practices figure prominently in your life today.
Yeah, there were a couple of periods. One when I was about 14, 15, when I started developing an interest in, well, in various things. A neighbor of mine at the time gave me lots of books, from Carlos Castaneda to The Power of the Subconscious. That's when I started to have a more direct interest in meditation and the idea of personal change. And then again, as an undergraduate student, I was avidly reading people like Jung and lots of transpersonal psychology, Groff, Stan Groff, and Ken Wilber. And I eventually even invited Stan Groff to come and give a a workshop to us, which was quite an interesting event, and which we write about in the book. At the same time, I was training to be a psychotherapist, and I was realizing that some of that hope which we're talking about how we can choose our path and how we proceed in our journey of evolution, how this was often not an easy journey, and it was paved with difficulties and lack of clarity. There's quite a lot of lack of clarity, as I realized when I started doing psychotherapy. So at the same time that I didn't lose hope, I started to realize that it wasn't as easy as I had foreseen as a young man.
Yes, you saw that many people probably were dealing more with the physical aspect and blame and control issues and thinking that it was other people creating their greatest problems, but they weren't going within to draw on the wisdom and the eternal life force of energy or soul. And I think you mentioned Jung just before. Every time he comes up in a show, I smile. Because he wrote something beautiful about a near-death experience that he had. And he knew we were multidimensional, eternal beings having a physical life just to refine our energy and the process of love and compassion. So every time I hear his name spoken on a show, I just smile, because that is the true way to help people change and find joy and positivity in life, by knowing who they are. If you don't know who you are, you have no balance or understanding of the duality of our energetic form and our physical life. There's really not the hope that we wish for people.
Yes, and I think you've used the right word, multidimensional.
That is.
That's really, really the right term. And it's difficult for us to deal with this multidimensionality. It's easier to try to see things in terms of black and white or a simple progression, and there's nothing like that. I think spiritual evolution is probably like time. Sometimes it seems that it's moving very, very slowly, and at other times it's moving very fast. Or like children develop language. Weeks go by in which they don't learn a new word, and then one moment to the other they start speaking whole new sentences.
Yes. So they have been absorbing the world around them and remembering what they already knew within them, and then it just comes out of them purely and simply, beautifully. And and the way they were born to know themselves. Unfortunately, along the way, many influences make us forget that early knowledge of who we are, and we spend the rest of our life trying to recover the pieces of our soul, so to put it. But you also wrote in the book that the Yoga Health Foundation states that there are more than 250 million people practicing it, and through yoga we learn to notice thoughts, feelings, sensations, the energy within and around us, and while working with physical postures, it opens the energy chakras of the body and inner soul essence. That's how I began my work as a Reiki energy practitioner. Many years ago, a medium told me that you will be going to a yoga class. I said, I don't think so. And then a week later, my hairdresser said to me, Cheryl, I have a ticket for a free yoga session. Would you come with me? And I said, of course, because I had been given the clue that it was necessary. And yoga and the language and the way I began to feel my own body and slow down from living just a physical life was the key. And later I learned Reiki energy healing and developed as a medium connecting to the multidimensional layers of information that are beyond this realm and above us. And so I love that you wrote that. The feelings, the sensations, the energy within and around us. And when people begin to focus on that, life changes dramatically.
Yes, but that's something which we've also realized while doing research for this book, which is that sometimes it completely surprises you when you're doing an exercise like yoga and it takes you to a deeper level. But quite a lot, what happens is that you have some expectations, some motivations of why you're doing it, and that will limit your experience. So if there's a survey showing that most people do yoga simply to get some kind of stress relief. So that's what they
I did it because I was told I must. And I really had no expectation. And so we're going to say to our listeners out there that anything that offers you an opportunity to grow and to know yourself better, if you're given that chance, just say yes and try a new approach and don't expect so much because then, of course, you can be disappointed or looking perhaps for the wrong clues or the wrong insights for yourself. So I think that's very good you just said that. But yeah. So you went on to talk about transcendental meditation, that your parents had practiced it. You want to tell us something about that? There was a long time I was doing meditation, but I wasn't exactly aware of the type I was doing. But transcendental was very important for a while. About the 1970s, there was quite a movement. So tell us something about that.
Well, transcendental meditation changed the, not just the Western world in terms of making meditation available to a huge number of people, especially young, educated people, but it also changed the way science approached meditation. It was what we call the first wave of meditation that gave rise to over 600 studies in only 5 years. And in the most prestigious scientific journals. And what they were interested in doing is very much what we see today with mindfulness. They wanted to show that meditation led to increased mental health and well-being on the one hand, but that it also made people act in more peaceful, less aggressive ways, so that meditation had an influence just beyond individual into the larger society.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, and you go on to tell us of a randomized controlled study with prisoners in the UK where a lack of change in most of the prisoners' aggressive behaviors after 10 weeks of yoga therapy and perhaps meditation was noted. Could this possibly be because they didn't really choose that activity, and that which we do not embrace or focus our intention on has little possibility of being helpful in any change we wish to make. So tell us something about that study. I found it very fascinating.
Yes, yeah, so it was back in 2009 that we met the director of an organization called the Prison Phoenix Trust, who have been organizing yoga and meditation classes across British prisons for the last 20 years. And there's a similar organization in the US, which was called the Ashram Project. I immediately fell in love with the idea of what they were trying to do, because they were trying to make this horrible, oppressive environment of the prison cell into a sort of ashram or a monastic cell. And there are interesting parallels between being in a monastery, in a small cell, where you have lots of restrictions about your behavior, and being in a prison cell. Anyway, what they're trying to do is to give an exercise which allows prisoners to break away from this violent, oppressive environment and give many of them the first opportunity in their lives to go within in a somewhat safe environment, I mean, through yoga and meditation. So we were hopeful about getting some positive results regarding mental health, stress relief, and even attention levels. And we did get all that. as we expected. So we were comparing prisoners that were doing 10 weeks of yoga and meditation versus those that were just doing their usual stuff. Now, the thing about the fact that, contrary to our expectations, we didn't notice any difference in aggression levels or in their interpersonal behavior. There possibly is something about what you're saying, that they hadn't chosen this, although all of them were interested in volunteering the study.
Well, also perhaps, Miguel, perhaps there wasn't a long enough period of time invested, and perhaps they needed other training to go along with that, a way to improve their view and perspective of themselves and life. And you know, it's a very hard process to change a person who has lived a certain way for a long time and to put them completely in a different stratosphere. But I'm sure they did develop a respect for the people helping them and for the peace that they and the feelings they began to feel, and a little control over their own mind and the feelings in their body as a result. So I'm sure a lot of good came out of it. Now, you mentioned a woman, Anne Weatherall, who joined Sir Alistair Hardy, who was a professor of zoology at Oxford, and he viewed humans as spiritual animals, theorizing that spirituality was really a natural part of human consciousness, and it's an awareness of something really much beyond human consciousness. Tell us something about those two people.
It's a fascinating story, starting with Alistair Hardy. As he approached retirement, he went back into his interest in spirituality. So he developed, in the late 70s, early 80s, the first large study on what was then called religious experience. We'd call it today spiritual experiences. So he and his team had over 5,000 people replying, just telling him about the unusual spiritual experiences they had. And these varied very considerably from being out in the countryside and having an expansion of their consciousness to various kinds of unusual dreams. And something else interesting was that although most of these experiences were of awe and elation, there were also some darker religious experiences.
Yeah, you also mentioned that there are examples of retreats gone wrong when students were overcome with increased anxiety or confusion after achieving a meditative state. So why does this sometimes happen? And how can people guard against the misuse, overuse, or poor use of meditative practices like yoga and meditation?
Yes, I think that is a question which we have to bring out and make people more and more aware of this. Because when something happens of unexpected and difficult, if the person isn't aware that this actually happens, she may actually blame herself for what is happening. There is this assumption that, you're not evolved enough or something of the sort, when it has nothing to do with that. There is some kind of mysterious interaction between the person's body and psyche and the meditation method, particularly when the meditation takes one to a deeper level of consciousness. So I actually didn't know about this some years ago. I had only heard something or read very loosely in Eastern spiritual traditions. But I had a student some years ago who used to be a yoga teacher and told me that one time during a meditation retreat, just a weekend meditation retreat, she started feeling farther and farther away from her body. And at first she thought this was a good symptom, but then the retreat ended and she kept feeling very, very distance from her body, and this eventually
she was disconnected. She needed grounding practices to bring her energy down, because it is all about energy and knowing how to work with energy. And some of the side effects that you even say could happen are twitching, convulsions, intense depression, which could become problems, not just for beginners, but for practice
yes.
meditation. So what we have to understand is here, everything has to be done in the proper environment and with proper training, perhaps with teachers, and to not overdo, not to stay in meditation like perhaps some monks might do it for 20 hours a day, but I certainly don't recommend that for anyone. Shorter states of meditation are very good in achieving a lowering of blood pressure, calming the body, allowing yourself to engage new, healthier thoughts. Personally, that's what I have found to work. When I go into a meditation for too long, I find it a little harder to come out of that state of restfulness and get on with my day. I just, you know, I'm over-relaxed, so to put it. So we need to balance.
Yes, I mean, a very good piece of common sense advice from the spiritual tradition is when you're, particularly when you're going for an extended period of meditation, whether it's two or more days, that then at the end of the retreat, you have to give yourself time to come back to real life, to everyday life.
I do Reiki energy healing sessions, and when a client is in that meditative, light, relaxed state, the energy actually within lifts up, and when the person opens their eyes, sometimes it's hard for them to do that, they want to stay in that state, they do have to pull their energy down and ground themselves again.
Right.
And there are techniques to do this that are very important to learn. So let's go on to the Buddha pill seeks to not only prove that there are negative as well as positive results of mindfulness, but to give us a more thorough understanding of these techniques and the reality of personal change. How can personal change be affected by meditation and yoga? It's not an easy pill. We don't just do it and achieve it.
No, so why we call it pill is actually particularly because the way it has become a mainstream technique in psychotherapy and clinical practice, particularly with mindfulness. And it's used as a group intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're trying to tell people to be somewhat cautious about this assembly line approach where you have a group of people. Sometimes there is little opportunity for an individualized approach. So we forget that people are different and they react differently to a meditation technique. The other thing which, well, I mean, why we call it a Buddha pill is because a meditation technique like Buddhist meditation, which traditionally is used to shake people up so that they can move into a deeper level of consciousness or self-awareness, is being used for a very, let's call it a very limited aim, which is to lower blood pressure or to decrease stress. So some traditional Buddhists are very unhappy about this very limited use of meditation, because taken out of the context, it loses some of its meaning and it becomes only a technique.
Right.
And a technique can be used for anything. It can be used for self-exploration, or it can be used to try to lower blood pressure. But as we know, it can also be used, as it is now, being used by the U.S. military to train soldiers before going to combat zones.
So right now, you wrote this, periodic inactivity is the single commonality among the variety of highly effective growth and therapy techniques, including progressive relaxation, biofeedback training, autogenic therapy, self-hypnosis, meditation, yoga. I'm going to include Reiki energy healing sessions, which all do this. They can help us on so many levels of understanding ourselves and life, as you just said, not to limit ourselves to just lowering blood pressure or stress. It is such a powerful way to learn more about ourselves individually and the world. So I would like your readers to take that away with them. Sometimes people hear yoga and meditation. They don't really know much about it, but after reading your book, they will understand the complexity and the value, and also the pitfalls that we want to avoid. So yeah. I want to thank you, Dr. Miguel Farias, and your co-author, Catherine Wilkham, for a unique dual-edged look at practices which many people are now interested in learning more about, including yoga and meditation and other energy healing practices, showing that a simplistic view of these practices help many people achieve real benefits, but some may only perceive some of the negative influences. For a thorough and in-depth view of healing using the mind, body, and spirit, yoga, and meditation practices, and to purchase this book, go to miguelfarias.com. In summarizing today's episode of Healing From Within, we have explored the history, beliefs, benefits, and some possible negative aspects of a growing interest in personal development and the tools of meditation and yoga to assist those interested in learning more about themselves, the mind, and the nature of healing and well-being through the use of various methods and practices. There is merit in the many ways we approach our deepest inner needs via dreams and other realities, while either scientifically motivated or spiritually guided, each person seeks to know themselves more completely and to understand the world and those around them in a more fulfilled, realistic, and intimate way. A Buddha pill, as McGill has written, may be what we wish to discover about life in general. And McGill wrote, I was struck to notice that a Benedictine monk had used almost exactly the same words as a Hindu ascetic. We could meditate for 22 hours a day, but during those two remaining hours, all kinds of unenlightened and selfish actions were possible. This brought to mind a prisoner I had met who told me he had been a Buddhist for years and nevertheless in prison now for committing an armed robbery. I like their non-pragmatic approach to the spiritual life. Neither of them believed in magical solutions to personal change. Rather, they believe it takes persistence, hard work, as well as an element of luck, fortune, and for God's grace. This realization is at odds with our culture of wanting immediate results, which some people hope to get through meditation. Is meditation then a Buddha pill? Miguel and I would hope you begin to go within and explore the wisdom and beauty of that place that connects to a higher realm of intelligence that does have your best interest at heart, and through your own awakening process, and yes, using certain tools or techniques, aid that process when you choose to explore the world of your spiritual essence as well as the physical world. The choice is for you to ask yourself what is truly important and to listen to that answer. I am Cheryl Glick, host of Healing From Within, and invite you to visit my website, CherylGlick.com, to discover the tools and theories that support our inner and physical realities, and to find the answers to many of your most pressing questions about energy healing and ways for self-development and the creation of a healthy, prosperous, and loving life journey. Shows may also be heard on DreamVision7Radio.com and WebTalkRadio.net. Thank you.